Good morning and welcome to Money Life for March the 10th. I'm Chuck Jaffe, senior columnist for Market Watch. We've got a lot of fun planned for you today. A really interesting show. Great lineup for you. No Money Life market call, which I know is a turnoff for some of you, but I think we've got enough to keep you tuned on and plugged in. It's Thursday, so we'll start our show today with Tom Lydon from ETF Trends in for the ETF of the week. After that, the first of two big interviews, this with Nathan Shadowin. Nathan is the manager, one of the managers, he's on the portfolio management team for the American Century Emerging Markets Fund. It's TWMIX, the ticker symbol. We'll be talking emerging markets with him. And, you know, I'm really curious about whether or not he sees the problem as being market-centric or commodity-centric. Because so much of the emerging market economies are dependent, so much of the emerging market economies are dependent on commodities that at times, rather than functioning the way, say, the markets do in a developed nation where it's what's the overall health of the country and how is that pushing things forward, you wind up with the entire market sort of being held down by a problem in the commodity that is the prevalent business. So we'll find out a little bit of that and what's going on there with him. Then Bob Powell in for our senior focus segment. Bob, of course, editor of Retirement Weekly, will be talking about Social Security claiming strategies. There are some changes that are being made. If you are eligible to claim or you know somebody who is eligible to claim, they have until the end of April. Bob is very nervous that people are going to wait. There are some changes that have been made that would eliminate some strategies, and people could be leaving tens of thousands of dollars on the table if they don't do it right. But if you wait and you go, okay, I got till the end of April, I'll wait, that the reduced staffing and everything else that Social Security is going to make it that you aren't going to get straight answers and you're not going to do it right. So we're going to talk about that and make sure you've got plenty of time, and hopefully you'll be able to make that work. Then our second big interview today is with Mark Hulbert. And I have to say, it's a bit of a bittersweet interview for me. Mark Hulbert and I have been friends for a long time. Mark is a senior columnist at MarketWatch, and that's really the title I guess I have to use for him. It's the same title, of course, that I have. But Mark, for the last 3.5 decades, has been known as the editor of the Hulbert Financial Digest. The Hulbert Financial Digest is a true resource for investors, for anybody who is looking at working with investment newsletters. Well, basically, 36 years ago, Mark started a newsletter that tracked what was happening with newsletters. So you'd have newsletter editors back in the day who would say, you know, I'm great, look at my portfolio, here's what it's done. And they would find ways to calculate it that weren't necessarily wrong entirely, like they weren't you're going to jail wrong, you know, they just weren't right by, say, any measure that you and I would consider right. So Mark started anonymously buying the newsletters, right? He was a customer. He wasn't saying give me a freebie, and then he would follow through with all the updates and he would process everything to actually measure track records. It created an amazing database and some research that has made Mark one of the smartest guys. He already was one of the smartest guys, but he now is backed by this huge database that talks about what people are doing right, what they're doing wrong, when trends are changing, and much, much more. Hulbert Financial Digest published its last edition at the end of February, and the database is going away. Basically, as we get every day we get into March, it becomes less and less likely that the data can be kept and preserved because, again, you know, if nobody's paying to keep it up and you don't follow the newsletters and enact the strategy by following the hotline recommendations and all that other stuff, which Mark and his staff were doing, then you wind up in a situation where the data goes cold and you can't really fix it. And that's where we're at. And Mark has become resigned to it. It is unfortunate. I'm actually writing about him for MarketWatch, but I think that it's better that you get to hear from him, because the flip side of it is the end of the Hulbert Financial Digest brings with it a number of lessons. And those are important for you to learn but they're doubly important now that you won't be able to listen to us on the show and know, oh, if it's Elliot Gew or Stephen McKee or Roger Conrad or Jason Brown and Janet Brown from No Load Fund X or Mark Salzinger from the No Load Fund Investor or whatever, that you have an independent check and balance. The way you have Morningstar to look at funds or Lipper to look at funds, it's a big deal. So we'll talk with Mark Hulbert. And again, it's bittersweet because I always love talking to Mark. He and I are friends and we've known each other for decades. I hate that it's under this circumstance. I'm Chuck Jaffe, senior columnist for Market Watch, host of this show every weekday. You can find my columns like Bob Powell's columns, like Mark Hulbert's columns at marketwatch.com. Different sections frequently, but you can find them there. You can also follow me on Twitter. I'm at MKTW Jaffe. Money Life is at Money Life Show. Money Life itself is independent personal finance talk. We believe in checking out all manner of investment approach. It's not just what I like or think you should follow because I do it. It's whatever's out there, good, bad, or otherwise, that I think you can learn from. Because disagreement makes a market, and you and I might not agree. And I don't just want you here because, oh, well, Chuck says this. I want you here listening for smart talk and good ideas. I want you to then vet those ideas on your own. But I also don't think you should be surprised because of how we do it. If somebody says buy something one day and someone comes on the next day and says sell it. Because that's what happens in the market, and it happens on this show. I'd love for you to be more involved. I've told you how to follow us on Twitter, but send me your questions, your comments, and more. Chuck@moneylifeshow.com. I'd love to hear from you. It's Money Life for March the 10th. Let's get busy. Tom Lydon to Nathan Shadowin to Bob Powell and then Mark Hulbert will roll things out with the ETF of the week when Money Life continues in just a moment.
Looking for alternative ETF strategies? Direction provides separate and distinct audiences with flexible investment tools to manage risk and execute short-term strategies. For more information, go to directionshares.com.
Tom Lydon joins us now for the ETF of the week. Tom, of course, is the editor at ETF Trends. He's here every week talking about ETFs, but ETFtrends.com, his website, is not just about Tom likes this or here's what the trend is talking about. It gives you everything you could want to know about ETFs. So check out the website, follow them on Twitter at ETF Trends. Tom is at Tom Lydon. Tom Lydon, welcome back to Money Life.
Thanks, Chuck. It's great to be back.
Our ETF of the week is
the Spider S&P Metals and Mining ETF, ticker symbol XME.
That's the XME, the Spider S&P Metals and Mining ETF. Now, Tom, of late, we've seen a tremendous amount of interest in gold. We have seen a lot of money flying in. There's been huge spikes in demand. But some of that tells me that, wow, there's so much interest. Does that make you think things are getting to a high? In your case, as you look at it, is it that actually for all the movement we've seen towards gold, the trend is really starting to show up and more importantly, pay off now?
Well, you're right on many fronts, Chuck. There's a situation where, yes, gold has come back. It's reached a one-year high, and that's fantastic. However, all commodities are not created equal. One thing is precious metals, gold, silver, platinum, palladium, tend to, in general, operate on the same trends. But when you look over at the miners, those companies that actually bring these metals out of the ground, they operate much differently. And especially those miners that have not only precious metals, but they produce industrial metals. And that's really what XME is all about. The majority of the companies that bring metals out of the ground are really focused on steel, over 50% based on the XME. They have, yes, silver, gold, aluminum, coal, consumer fuels are all part of it. It's kind of a diversified offering. So let's look at that sector. First of all, we've had a huge decline in that area in general in the past 4 years. This ETF, for example, from its high to its low, was down over 70%. However, just from the second week in January till most recently, this ETF was up over 50%. But not only that, was above its 200-day average for the first time in a long time. And as you and I talk about, that's a trend, or when we identify trends, it's really important to say, look, something might have changed in the overall economics and the fundamental of this asset class. And in talking to smart folks on Wall Street, like you do all the time, we're starting to see a couple things. Number one, demand has increased while supply has decreased. And you know what that means? It ends up meaning higher prices. And that's really the key behind XME at this point. Yes, there was threat 3 months ago about rising interest rates. However, with all the turbulence overseas and also potential challenges that we've had here in the U.S., if the Fed doesn't hike interest rates four times this year, that's probably good for the commodity sector, while we're also seeing kind of slow and increasing commodities prices, which also affect inflation, right?
Mm-hmm. When you talk about crossing the 200-day moving average, you talked about the good, strong run-up that this fund has seen since January. But I'm assuming that we didn't get past the 200-day moving average till something more recent, that that's a development that was the last thing that turned the light on here.
Well, it is. And what we try to talk about with the ETF of the week is give people maybe key things to keep an eye on. But if you go back and you look at the chart going back to 2014, the fall of 2014, that was the last time this ETF broke below its 200-day average. So a very long period of time, a very long downtrend, and now we're in a situation where it's peaked its head above that moving average. So look at it this way. Number one, ask yourself within your portfolio, do you currently have a commodities allocation? And many folks do. Number two, is most of that commodities allocation attributed to gold? In many cases, that is the case. But if it is attributed to miners in some degree, in most cases, it's gold miners. So industrial metals do play a big role in the global economies. Look at these areas, especially areas that have been beat up and now have some indication that the trend may have changed. So if you're a trend follower, and we talk about this fairly regularly, and you're looking for areas to take advantage of that maybe have been beat up, that maybe are less expensive, as in this case, the price to book and the securities within this index are under 1. It's 0.93 versus the S&P 500, which is 2.34. They're almost giving away at this point. So if you've got the staying power, or if you have the ability to watch something very closely, here's a new trend that's developed, and especially considering the economics and the fundamentals in the marketplace, this might be something that will last for a while.
You prefer this to the exchange-traded commodities like an IAU or a GLD, which hold the metal itself, and you would rather do it that way? Or are you splitting your allocation, some with the miners, some with the metals?
Yeah, so this is invested in equities that produce the metals themselves. There are obviously other ETFs that represent physically backed gold, metals, silver, platinum, palladium, and then there's some that are futures-based. I look at it this way. As long as you can play the market and it's true, and the allocation is accurate over an extended period of time, great. But really, in talking about industrial metals and specifically steel, which amounts to a big portion of this buy here, the trends changed. The companies that are making steel today have really been on a hiatus for maybe 3 years. The question is, are economies coming back? And if so, they're going to have to build and they're going to have to buy product from these companies.
That is why the SPDR S&P Metals and Mining ETF, the XME, above the 200-day moving average, on the rise sharply since January. It's the ETF of the week. Tom, thanks as always for joining us. Look forward to doing it with you again next week.
Thanks, Chuck.
Tom Lydon is editor at ETF Trends. It's ETFTrends.com, at ETF Trends on Twitter, at Tom Lydon on Twitter as well. Up next, our big interview, so settle back and relax. We're living the money life, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Hightower is a groundbreaking team of financial advisors committed to giving you access to best-in-class financial products and services, a practice often overlooked by brokers on Wall Street. Visit HightowerAdvisors.com to learn more about the Hightower difference.
Let's face it, size matters.
Truly epic proportions.
Especially when it comes to your financial talk.
I have a plan.
Quick sound bites and rush chatter won't help you.
Blah, 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 blah.
You want more details, more depth.
Concentrate, focus power.
More to think about.
What do you think?
This is Money Life's Big Interview.
I think it's brilliant.
A meaningful conversation on money and markets.
This is why we're here.
So settle in.
I made you coffee.
You're going to be here a while.
That's just perfect.
It's big interview time, or more appropriately, the first of our two big interview times today here on Money Life. I'm joined right now by Nathan Shadowin. He is manager, part of the team that manages the American Century Emerging Markets Fund. That's TWMIX if you're looking for the ticker symbol. And if you're looking for more information, well, you'll either go to AmericanCentury.com or, well, actually, and, because you can do both, you'll follow the company on Twitter. At American Century. Nathan Shadowin, welcome to Money Life.
Hello, sir. Thank you for having me.
Emerging markets have been a place that for many, many investors through the end of last year, coming into this year, have been very, very scary. Now, the truth is great investors will tell you, you know, go where the blood's running in the streets, find the scary things, be smart when other people are running scared. But it's still, for a lot of folks right now, tough to say, wow, I really want to be committed to emerging markets. Why, when you look at emerging markets, and separate from the fact that you run a fund that is obviously committed to them,
right.
But why would you tell somebody, hey, this is why you need the allocation, and this is what you can expect in terms of how these tough times are likely to play out going forward?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's a good question, and certainly one that's very, very common in our client meetings so far this year. I would say this, like the fears that the market was struggling with to begin the year, okay, so China losing control of its domestic equity market, followed by its currency. You had what, Fed policy in the midst of weak developed market data. You had collapse in the commodity market. Those risk factors are now beginning to fade, beginning to stabilize. Okay. So I would say then longer term, we're also starting to see some relatively encouraging signs again of stabilization in our asset class as well. The end of the dollar bull market, you know, again, ahead of that initial Fed hike, you know, implies certainly less pressure on emerging market currencies, right? You have room for policy intervention and easing in particularly countries in Asia. Thailand, Philippines, Indonesia, Malaysia, you know, all have room to cut rates. And then when you add, I would say, relatively attractive relative valuations, you know, certainly to developed markets, and some investor sentiment beginning to improve, yeah, I think there's a number of interesting opportunities in the emerging markets. So what you're seeing is basically, you know, a number of risk factors that were weighing on the asset class as a whole now beginning to fade, quite frankly. And that's how we're positioned really today, is really for around some, I would say, some initial stabilization in our asset class, then followed by a broader recovery, if you will, as we go forward through the year.
Okay. How much of the issues that people hear about in emerging markets are caused by the actions of the country? How much of it, of the specific countries that we're talking about, how much of it is caused by how commodity driven the economies of the various countries are, and, you know, which comes first in creating both promise and trouble? Is it the country or is it the commodity?
Yeah, I mean, look, and that's the challenge, right? Finding stocks that are going to continue to grow, you know, their earnings, despite the fact that there's just massive downward pressure on these countries, largely due to these, what we just discussed, these broad, broad macro factors. So not necessarily EM specific per se, but just these broader macro factors, the strong dollar, weak commodities weighing on just the outlook for global growth, which obviously if that's depressed, puts further pressure on the emerging markets. So, you know, that's what we're trying to do literally every day. And that's what we focus on every single day is, again, trying to identify these opportunities at the stock level that's going to still be able to grow, and particularly their earnings, despite, again, this broader macro environment being, I mean, challenging, largely due to, just as you refer to, the impending collapse of the commodity market, which we're now finally starting to see some stabilization. So that's, you know, going to the point about, you know, the forward looking, right? Not necessarily what we had to start the year, but now where we're going forward, now that we've seen that, you know, basically since the last half of January, seen some stabilization in the commodity price. But clearly, to answer your question, clearly, the strong dollar and weak commodity price has a just massive, massive downward pressure on the emerging markets.
Okay. Now, when an investor is considering it, one of the things that a lot of folks have said, average investors, this means, and folks in my audience, perhaps,
sure,
is that over the last few years, while emerging markets have had a rocky ride, if they and in fact, international stocks in general, not just emerging markets, but Europe and developed markets have had a rocky ride. If they wanted to get some measure of exposure internationally, they would simply own large cap U.S. stocks, which were doing the best anyway, and gave them plenty of international exposure. How true is that when it comes to emerging markets? I mean, if you're looking at a giant multinational company like, say, a Coca-Cola, which for full disclosure purposes for my audience, yes, I own Coca-Cola in my own personal portfolio. I think of Coca-Cola, of course, as a giant multinational. And I've always said part of the attraction of the stock to me was that, you know, so many folks in China were going to get their first taste of America out of a red and white can. But is that acceptable in terms of getting exposure to emerging markets? Have we gotten global enough that we have that exposure without specializing, or do we need to specialize in order to make sure that we get a more full exposure and we get the kind of growth that these emerging market economies should give us over time?
Yeah, I mean, look, I would argue on the behalf of specialization, and just to the latter point that you made there, is that to get the growth that these economies can deliver. So, you know, where we try to focus, you know, the vast majority of our risk is really what we see in terms of the positive trends of the domestic demand in the emerging markets themselves. So there's massive, massive dispersion between countries, right? I mean, just the fundamentals in one country versus another are clearly different. And so what we're trying to do is, again, isolate the opportunity not only at the country level, but then focusing on, again, those stocks within that country that are going to continue to grow their earnings. So we like the specialization, okay? Again, domestic demand driven, domestic emerging market driven, rather than solely, you know, those multinationals like Coca-Cola, for example, that you refer to. So for our process and for our purpose here at American Century, we're much more focused again on what we see within the emerging markets themselves as it relates to that growth profile as, you know, GDP per capita continues to improve and that middle class continues to expand and all the, you know, the wonderful, you know, themes, if you will, that you've heard around the emerging markets going forward.
When you consider emerging markets, which ones are the attractive ones right now? Which ones are the ones you avoid? Because as a general rule, if folks go to a specialized fund, they're looking at the BRICS or they're looking at something along those lines. Is there a point where you see more promise in a few specific nations and you would rather break it up, or is it by the field?
Yeah, no, it's certainly specialization, again, going, you know, alluding to your previous question as well. So look, we're still relatively active in China. We like the, you know, the China H share market. We don't invest in the A share market, but, you know, we like the infrastructure plays there that are directly supported by the government, you know, particularly the green initiatives. We have a number of tier one and select tier two, property developers, a couple of insurance names, and certainly those that are moving towards the internet. Also, lately, I would say we've been increasingly active in Thailand and also in Indonesia. So, I mean, look, Thailand is, you know, there's certainly some political risk that still overhangs the economy there, but recent economic data is continuing to improve. The economy continues to expand ahead of market expectations. I mean, basically, fiscal stimulus is moving away from specific subsidies now to public investments. Basically, the government is starting to improve their spending momentum as it relates to, again, infrastructure plays. So as we see governments, Thailand and Indonesia being another good example of that, increasing their CapEx relative to their GDP toward, you know, infrastructure spending, we see some very, very interesting opportunities there as it relates to stocks that are going to benefit from, in this case, government intervention. We also, too, like the tourism sector in Thailand. some countries that we kind of stay away from, per se. I mean, we don't necessarily have a firm top-down view, per se, that says, okay, alleviate this country versus another. But countries that were particularly underweight, India, for example, which is certainly a non-consensus view. I mean, with the election of Mr. Modi, clearly there was some very positive momentum around the country, just in general. And again, similar to the stories that I just relayed with Indonesia and Thailand around expected government stimulus coming through. What we're seeing there in India, though, it's just taking longer than the market had initially expected. And, you know, the earnings season has just come through, which was really, really weak, quite frankly. So what we saw there was that basically the market get it ahead of itself and expectations. Basically, and, you know, at the end of the day, earnings is going to drive stock prices, right? And Mr. Modi's election, you know, unfortunately just doesn't change the earning environment of a country or a subsequent company overnight. So we're still relatively cautious on India. Latin America as well, I mean, that's nothing new there as it relates to the political situation in Brazil. We do have a number of interesting stocks around the Mexican consumer. But I would say, yeah, China, Indonesia, Thailand, select plays in the Korean cosmetics sector as well, and some IT in Taiwan, excuse me. But outside of that, we're pretty much focused on the stock level, really, and saying, again, despite this macro environment, despite these headline risk, which companies are going to grow their earnings power over the course of the next few years?
Well, Nathan, really interesting stuff. I wish I had more time to chat about it. I don't, so we're just going to have you back at some point. But thanks so
with
much. Thanks so much for taking time out to join me on Money Life.
Thank you, sir.
Nathan Shadowin is part of the portfolio management team for the American Century Emerging Markets Fund. TWMIX is the ticker symbol. At American Century on Twitter, AmericanCentury.com for more information. Up next, Bob Powell in for Senior Focus. That's here on Money Life right after this message.
Customize an investment portfolio with FlexShares, ETFs designed to pursue targeted goals and to adapt to changing market conditions with both equity and fixed income solutions. For more information, go to FlexShares.com.
Your retirement years are coming. Are you financially ready for your retirement?
You know, I've been thinking.
Oh, that would explain the beads of sweat.
Don't let this happen to you.
I'm afraid it's just not sufficient to refinance your home.
Where shall I go? What shall I do?
My advice to you is to start drinking heavily.
Just a minute, ladies and gentlemen. I think something is happening.
Bob Powell knows where to turn and how to help you with your financial needs as you plan for or live in retirement.
Here I come to save the day.
It's all here as Retirement Weekly's Bob Powell joins Money Life every week for Senior Focus.
Senior citizens, although slow and dangerous behind the wheel, can still serve a purpose.
Coming here to save the day, as he does each Thursday at this time, is Bob Powell. He is the editor at Retirement Weekly. He joins us each week for our Senior Focus segment. And whether you're a senior or not, well, today's topic is going to appeal to you because I have to say, I've had a lot of discussions of late with people who are around the point where they're starting to think about claiming Social Security, should they take it, and everything else. And beyond simply when do you do it, there are a lot of Social Security claiming strategies. And this is one of the reasons why you want to turn to somebody like Bob for help, because this is not the kind of thing that you want to go, oh, I heard one thing one time, and that's going to be the best fit for me. And there's a lot of changes that are going on to how this stuff is working. Now, the deadline for claiming for this year is at the end of April, so we're a bit ahead of it, and that's why it's a perfect time to cover the subject with Bob. But before we do that, a quick reminder. Beyond being the editor of Retirement Weekly, Bob Powell is a columnist for the Retire Mentors section at MarketWatch. Go there to find his work. And while you're there, since Retirement Weekly is a MarketWatch product, you will be able to find links to the newsletter. That said, follow Bob on Twitter. He's at RJPIII because beyond the newsletter and his columns for MarketWatch, he writes in a bunch of places and you can find his work a lot more easily if you're following him on Twitter. Bob, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
So we could probably talk every week from now until the end of April about Social Security claiming strategies and not fully cover the ground. But we don't want to bother people, but we do want to alert anybody who's got a looming deadline about what their options are, right?
Yeah. So let's start with three categories of folks. If you're currently married, if you're parents with dependent or disabled children, and if you're an individual. Here, the deadline I want you to keep in mind, right? So April, right? T.S. Eliot said April is the cruelest month, and it's in more ways than one this April, which not only do taxpayers have to deal with the, all things April 15th, but these older Americans have to deal with this deadline of April 29th. So write down April 29th, and that's the deadline by which you must take advantage of one of these Social Security claiming strategies. So, and write this down too. If you were age 65 and a half or older by October 29th, 2015, that is, you were born April 30th, 1950 or earlier, you can still file and suspend your Social Security benefit. It's still available at full retirement age, but you must file by April 29th. That exists if you're currently married, if you're a parent with dependent and disabled children, or if you're a single, although not necessarily divorced. If you're unmarried, divorced, this file and suspend option is not available to you. That's the first thing that you need to think about is, okay, should I file and suspend? And file and suspend is, in essence, the tactic by which you say, I'm going to file for my Social Security benefit and then suspend it so I'm not receiving my benefit and then take advantage of the delayed retirement credits. By doing that, what your spouse is able to do is then to file a restricted application so that they can claim the spousal benefit. And that's available for people who are not only age 65 and a half or older by October 29th, 2015, but also for those who are age 62 or older in 2015 and those born in 1953 or earlier or on January 1st, 1954. Mm-hmm. It gets a little complicated. I can't tell you how many questions I get from people saying, do I still qualify? I was born on such and such a date or I'm this old and do I qualify? In the column that we're about to produce, there's going to be a table that gives you the dates and who's eligible and who's not eligible and for which person the strategies are applicable and which ones they're not. But, you know, keep in mind, file and suspend is available, currently married, parents with disabled or dependent children, and individuals. So if you do want to file and suspend, you know, you want to make sure that you review that you're old enough. If you're old enough to use the strategy, you want, before you do it, you want to check and see if it makes sense. A couple calculators, one you can find at Financial Engines to see if this makes sense for you. And then if it does make sense, get over to the SSA office right away. And then most importantly, verify that your request was processed correctly. You know, if you file and suspend, you should not be receiving benefits based on your earnings history. If you start to receive checks that don't seem right, don't ignore them and think it's found money. You know, go to the SSA right away and tell them to fix the error, right? A lot of times people don't fix errors and they can't unfix them. The other thing is if you want to do restricted application, same kind of thing applies. You have to review if you're old enough to be grandfathered in under the old rules. So in essence, you had to be age 62 or older by January 1st, 2016. And then like the file and suspend, you want to make sure that it makes sense to you. So use one of those calculators. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you've got to remember that you can only file a restricted application once you reach FRA or age 66. And once you reach that age, you can file for that restricted application. And then same thing, verify that your request was processed correctly. So those are the, you know, the big ones that people have to worry about is if they're currently married and they meet these age requirements, they can take advantage of it. If you don't meet the age requirements, it really means that you're not eligible. You don't even have to worry about this. And for many people, as folks who read the column will find out in the table, you'll find that who's eligible and who's not.
You know, so many things in retirement you could screw up. Are there things that somebody's got to worry about where they go, wow, if I really screw this up, it's a problem for me?
Yeah, and this is one of them. And, you know, there's going to be a mad dash. I wouldn't want to be a Social Security Administration, you know, customer service rep or office person at the moment. Because this, unlike many other financial matters, has really confused people, right? They don't know if they qualify. They don't know what the deadline is. They don't know where to file a restricted application. In essence, you have to go into the office to do it. To the best of my knowledge, you can't do it online. And that's the other thing. If there's a mad rush to go visit a SSA office where there's already restricted hours and maybe reduced personnel, you don't want to wait until April 29th of 2016 to go visit an office. You want to schedule a visit right away, book an appointment, and get there this month, not next month. To at least, you know, review your options, see if you qualify, and then take advantage of it if it's available. I should mention that this is a benefit. These two, what were called unintended loopholes, in some households could add tens of thousands, 50, 60, 70,000, upwards of $70,000 in extra Social Security benefits for people who do it right. So it's not an insignificant sum of money. It's there. Time is of the essence. And don't wait till the last minute.
Take it if you can get it because, well, why would you leave money on the table? Great stuff, Bob. And of course, if folks want more information, they'll find it in your column at marketwatch.com or in Retirement Weekly. Bob, we'll talk to you again next week.
Thanks, Chuck. Talk to you then.
Bob Powell is editor of Retirement Weekly. Find his columns at marketwatch.com. Follow the links for the newsletter. Follow him on Twitter at RJPIII. Up next, another columnist from Market Watch, Mark Hulbert, the editor of the Hulbert Financial Digest, which sadly is going away. We'll talk about that and more when Money Life continues in just a moment.
When it comes to managing your financial portfolio, Hightower's advisors don't limit your access to proprietary financial products and services, a common Wall Street practice. At Hightower, you get unobstructed advice. Visit HightowerAdvisors.com to learn more about the Hightower difference.
Time to get ready.
Of course. Ready for what?
It's the big interview. Thinking big, living big, talking big with market strategists, money managers, economists, authors, and more.
Get ready to feel the thunder.
Long chats with big brains meant to give you a better view of the big picture.
As far as brains go, I got the lion's share.
As Money Life goes, big time.
Big reason for this success is you.
Literally.
Welcome back to Money Life, where it's big interview time. And, you know, we promise you big thinkers here on Money Life. And one of the biggest thinkers I know is Mark Hulbert, who you probably know him these days as a columnist for Market Watch, although his work and mine sort of go in very different directions in terms of what we do. But for 3.5 decades, Mark has been the editor of the Hulbert Financial Digest. And the Hulbert Financial Digest would look at newsletters and it would help track other newsletters. And it was an absolutely essential resource to help get newsletters out of their wild, wild west days where they were claiming lots of things and getting to where you could understand who was a good newsletter editor, who was somebody that was managing a portfolio well, and more. And unfortunately, Hulbert Financial Digest published its last at the end of February. So we're going to discuss that and markets with Mark Hulbert. If you want to get more information about Mark, you can follow him on Twitter. He's at MKTW Hulbert, the way I'm at MKTW Jaffe, and you can find his columns at marketwatch.com. Mark Hulbert, welcome back to Money Life.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
I am somewhat distraught, but maybe that's because I'm a fan of Hulbert Financial Digest. How distraught are you that 3.5 decades plus of work is now coming to this end? And why is it coming to an end? Help my audience understand, because we talk to newsletter editors on this show all the time, and they need an arbiter to help sort out who's good and who's not.
Well, it's one of those things. I mean, of course, I'm distraught. I've unfortunately seen this coming for some time. The economics of the industry are such that it's just not... it's not favorable to an operation like mine. Lots of people are glad that I existed, but fewer than that many were willing to pay for it. And that is, and of course, in the end, the problem. I sold the company to CBS MarketWatch about 14, 15 years ago, and then it was in turn that firm bought by Dow Jones. And Dow Jones, entirely fairly, had to make a business decision about where to put its resources. And when I was not, my operation just not making enough money to justify its existence, it closed it down. And the real surprising thing for me was that I was unable to find other firms that were willing to take it on. And I think in that sense, they were providing a backhanded confirmation of the judgment Dow Jones was making, and that is that however good a public service it is, if people aren't willing to pay for it, it's going to be difficult to make it a go.
Yeah, well, and those of us in the podcast and radio world, we understand how that happens too. We have lots of people who like us and not necessarily lots of folks who want to pay for us. But in your case, you also have this database that is remarkable that sadly, I mean, by the time we get to like the end of this month, you're obviously not going to continue to keep the database. What happens there? And how do you view it as a loss? I mean, What do you say to my audience when we talk about somebody from like Stephen McKee from No Load Mutual Fund Selections and Timing, or the No Load Fund X guys, or folks that they've come to know who have traditionally had good Hulbert ratings? What do you say to them so that they try to understand what those folks are doing going forward?
Well, I guess I tend to take a somewhat of a more philosophical view of it. Of course, I'm forced to, because what else am I going to do, right? But it turns out that, you know, even though this doesn't sound like much solace to a newsletter who is performing well and wants to be able to use my ratings to tell the world on how good they are, from the point of view of the individual investor, we probably, and this is going to sound like after the fact justification, but I'm afraid it's true, we probably already know what we need to know. I've been doing this for 36 years, and we have answers to some age-old questions. And I'm afraid those questions, are in many ways, a bit of an answer that may not be favorable to the advisors who would otherwise like to advertise their great ratings. I'd say that perhaps the most important lesson, one you and I have talked about many times, is just how difficult it is to beat the market. I remember I went back and looked at some notes of a talk I gave back right after I started my newsletter in the early 1980s, and I used an interesting locution. I said, if we got together in 30 years and compared how we did starting then until 30 years hence, we'd find that almost all of you would have done better if you put your money in Vanguard's Index 500 fund and did nothing else for the next 30 years. And it turns out that, if anything, I was being too optimistic. In fact, hardly anyone has beaten the market over that period of time. And this is not just true of newsletters. It's true of hedge funds. It's true of mutual funds. It's true of money managers and so forth. So the fact is that, as we probably have been told a million times and always end up forgetting, it's difficult to beat the market. But it's even more depressing than that. And that is that even if you took that group, that very select group of advisors who've beaten the market over a particular period of time, and looked at just them alone going forward, you'd find that most of them end up not beating the market. And so the inescapable conclusion is that most of the year-to-year, if not even more so the quarter-to-quarter and month-to-month gyrations in our performance, either our portfolio's performance, our advisor's performance, you name it, is random. It's luck. It has nothing to do with skill. And here we are in an industry where we want to focus on that group of advisors and those strategies that have proven records, on the theory that we're really giving us a leg up. And to the extent that the world is a statistically rigorous place in which skill really comes out on top, that's a very good thing to do. And I'm proud of what I've did for the last 36 years. But I have to be honest that far more of a person's track record is a function of luck than it is of skill.
And indeed, you just wrote a column for MarketWatch that was talking about Geraldine Weiss and Investment Quality Trends, a newsletter that sort of has a Warren Buffett-like track record in terms of its ability to deliver consistently. But the ultimate moral of the story for folks is find a strategy that you're comfortable with and live with it, rather than jump around. Because the one thing that's even worse than, hey, you bought somebody and they may not beat the market, is you bought somebody and then you bought the next somebody and the next somebody, right?
Well, that's right. So that's good thing to illustrate with Geraldine Weiss, her newsletter is called Investment Quality Trends. It's currently edited by Kelly Wright, who took over for her in the early aughts, so maybe, 10, 15 years ago, but pursuing very similar strategies. And it has a great track record. But get this. It's beaten the market by about 1 percentage point a year on an annualized basis over the last 30 years, which is how long I've been tracking it. Well, one thing to take away from that is just to realize that most people, if you look at the advertisements that draw us in and think, oh, we need to go with this advisor or that strategy, are advertising returns that are multiples more than the market itself. Whereas, in fact, even among those very few advisors who have beaten the market over the very long term, they're beating it by only about a percentage point a year or more. Buffett has done a little bit better, but he clearly is the exception rather than the rule. He's beaten the S&P by, I think, around 8 or 9 percentage points a year on an annualized basis. If you go back over the last 10 or 15 years, his margin over the market has started to come back down to earth. So much of his long-term performance over the market is a function of some of those earlier years. One thing we can take away from that is that let's say that you are fortunate enough to have found an advisor whose track record is worth following over the very long term, and you have the discipline, as you correctly mentioned, is crucial. You have the discipline to track it over time. What can you expect? Well, if all you can expect is about a percentage point per year more than the market, which is impressive in its statistical sense, but you might very well decide, wow, I have low odds of finding the good advisor to begin with, and B, it requires a heck of a lot of discipline that I may not have. And if I jump over those two high hurdles, guess what? My victory, my reward, is to beat the market by less than a percentage point a year. You could easily and almost justifiably conclude that it's not worth it.
You know, you talked about the research done sort of shows the things that are important. But what happens in the void left behind by Hulbert Financial Digest is that we're going to wind up with new newsletters making claims, et cetera, that nobody's necessarily going to be able to verify or nobody's going to be looking to verify.
But the thing that's interesting to point out there is that even while I existed over the last 36 years, it hasn't been the case that outrageous advertising has been put out of business. I mean, the thing that I underestimated 36 years ago in 1980 when I started this is the ingenuity of marketing and advertising personnel to figure a way of wriggling out from underneath what I would have thought was an absolutely damning track record. And so the tricks, we've all seen the tricks, we all know the tricks, and yet people still believe them, and the marketers are still successful. And so I haven't really put bad advertising out of business, much as I would hope that I would have done so. So, I have to be utterly honest here. As I reflect on the 36 years, I think it was a great public service. I think you perhaps most correctly in your intro pointed out that it sort of brings the newsletter industry out of the Wild West sort of, reputation that it had, and it brings it back down to, oh, well, it has some respectability and some stability and some ability to actually verify its results. And that can maybe put it back into the same realm as mutual funds and professional money managers, something that people can hang their hat on. So, in effect, the newsletter industry should probably be thanking me for having done that, even though they were more likely to sue me than to thank me.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, it's a rather modest goal. Okay, now you're as good as the average hedge fund or the average mutual fund, or for average money manager, you'd say big deal. Most of them don't beat the market either. So, it's like it's a Pyrrhic victory that the newsletter industry wins. As I say, this is no solace to a newsletter editor who obviously is advertising that he or she can beat the market. And indeed, some of them can, and some of them deserve all the accolades that they can get. But, again, in terms of the broad brushstrokes, what does an investor need to take away from this could easily be that either the odds of success are so low and the rewards of winning are so modest in any case that maybe I should just put my money in an index fund, boring as that sounds,
yeah,
and get on with the rest of our lives.
I'm going to ask one quick question, and it'll be the last question in the newsletter. But I'm curious, for my audience, as they go forward, there's going to come a point, as we point out, the database and the research, unless somebody surprises you and winds up picking it up and buying it from your company and what have you, that research is going to stop. So if over the course of 2-3 years, what have you, they get something from a newsletter that says, hey, I got great marks from Hulbert Financial Digest, how quickly would you tell them, hey, if you see somebody advertising us and we're not around anymore, even if what they're saying is true, that you discount it?
Well, I think there's always a trust but verify sort of attitude that we should take to all advertising, right? Not just for newsletter advertising. And so, putting that a little more bluntly, you shouldn't believe anything, right? I mean, people may be telling the truth, but they may not be, and there's no way a priori to tell. So I recommend, and this is the same answer I'd give at any point over the last 36 years, there were plenty of newsletter editors whose marketers who lied about their records, even when I was around to say to the contrary. And by the way, I'm not going anywhere. I can still point it out. I'll have a platform in my MarketWatch column, for example. So, you know, these are these truths that we have to remind ourselves are truths that we already know, and we all know them so well, and we forget them. So sort of like, you know, rule number two is don't forget rule number one.
Right.
And, you know, that's, I think, one of the most important messages to take away from this is that, you know, good, solid, long-term investing, having the discipline to stick through it through thick and thin, it sounds boring. We've heard it a million times. It's not exciting. It's all those sort of things. But it turns out to be true.
We're almost out of time here, but I would be remiss if I didn't at least ask for your market take. It's very interesting, your critics, and of course, as a senior columnist for MarketWatch, I get some of your blowback every now and again, where it's somebody going, well, you know, you're not as unhappy with the market as Hulbert is, or what have you. I think people read your columns and think, and you have recently written one that says, you know, you're not going to make as much money going forward as you did in the past. I think people read your columns and sometimes think that you are more doer about the market than I've ever known you to be. I think you're very realistic about the numbers, but I'm curious, am I misreading things? Because like I said, I get that blowback from people who think you're completely bearish, and I've never known you to be anything other than here's what the numbers are telling me, and let's talk about what the numbers tell me, and sometimes they tell me good, and sometimes they tell me bad.
Well, I look at it as that I'm a contrarian, and so when everyone is bullish, I'll say that that's not a good sign for the market, not because I'm just a curmudgeon, but because that's what the contrarian data show, and vice versa. So, for example, in late January, early February, when it looked like the world was going to come to an end, we had the worst start to a stock market in a calendar year ever in U.S. history. And if you go back and look at my columns, and they're all archived on the website, I was saying that this is the sentiment data suggested that we had a powerful rally in store. Now, you know, we didn't know when it would begin and so forth, but it was the sentiment conditions were inconsistent. Let's put it that way. They were inconsistent with the start of a bear market. Usually in the beginning of a bear market, you have the mood being skeptical that it really is that bad. In this case, by early February, you had people throwing in the towel that hadn't thrown in the towel in a long time, and we actually had record levels of bearishness among some of the market timers we track. And that's what allowed contrarians to conclude that a rally was not unlikely. And that's what I reported in some of my columns. So it's not like I'm always bearish. So I think that's worth stressing. I do try to follow the data. I obviously have opinions, and a column gives one platform to express those opinions. But I think it will be consistent that every time everyone thinks that happy days are here again and the stock market's going to go to the moon and that sort of thing, you are going to find me say, no, that's not probably going to happen. And my columns have started to go in that direction just in the last week or so as the market has been stronger than people imagine it to be. The sentiment conditions right now are not as favorable as they were in early February. Now that the market's had a very powerful rally, a lot of people have jumped back on the bullish bandwagon, thereby taking away some of that wind in the bull sails that would otherwise propel it higher.
Well, Mark, I don't even tell my audience that as a MarketWatch senior columnist, I'm a must read. I hope that they read my stuff. But Mark, you are a must read at MarketWatch. And I'm sorry that we're not going to get to read more about Hulbert Financial Digest, because I was one of the folks that truly believed in the product and I loved it. You did a great service. And under any circumstances, your columns will continue to do that service. I look forward to chatting with you again here on the show, not too distant future.
Thank you so much.
Mark Hulbert is senior columnist at MarketWatch, just like me. But in his case, you follow him on Twitter at MKTWHulbert, and you can get more information at MarketWatch.com. Hey, we're just about done with today's show, but just about means not quite. Let's cross the finish line together when Money Life wraps things up right after this message.
PowerShares provides a different take on traditional asset categories while providing advisors and investors with innovative investment opportunities. For more information, go to PowerShares.com. Invesco Distributors Incorporated.
Well, that was fun. I always love talking to Mark Hulbert. I'm glad that I got a chance to do it, and I'm really pleased that I'm writing a piece for MarketWatch that basically looks at the end of Hulbert Financial Digest, it is a serious loss. Now, I'm going to point something out. When I pick our Money Life quotes of the day, and I am the one who picks them, because I am a control freak and I do all the stuff on this show, but when I pick our Money Life quotes of the day, I basically am putting quotes that I like into calendars. I typically try to find something appropriate for a weekend, maybe for a Friday, but otherwise I'm pretty much agnostic and just kind of throw them in there in days and what have you. And every now and again, you just kind of get circumstances that go, oh, okay, we just talked to Mark Hulbert, and when you get to the quote of the day today, it's like, I think Mark Hulbert just kind of said that this quote is ridiculous. Because he was talking about, hey, the chances of beating the market are so slim that nobody can really do it. So you'll hear a quote that happens to be about beating the market, and I didn't even, until I just opened it up to say, hey, I got to check the quote and make sure I've got it ready to go, until I just opened it up, I didn't actually realize what it was. We have big things planned. Tomorrow on this show, you've got a great lineup. Jim Welsh will be in for our technical difficulty segment. Axel Merck, who's been very bearish, will be in for our big interview. Greg McBride from Bankrate.com and John Buckingham from The Prudent Speculator, Al Frank Asset Management, will be our Money Life Market Call guest. That is an awesome lineup. But it continues as we get into Monday, right? Monday, we will be doing a survey, a chat about with Steve Nice, senior economist from Willis Towers Watson, about some really interesting survey research. We'll have Norton Reamer, who's written sort of the ultimate investment book. It's called Investment, A History. He's the former chief executive officer at Putnam Investments, but the book is really interesting. Then we'll have David Trainer in, and we'll have Tom Windmill, manager of the Midas Fund. We'll be talking about gold. Now, we're getting that done because, of course, I'm going to wind up being away. I'm going down. I'm very sad to say this. I'm probably only going to see three more games for my daughter playing lacrosse in person. This is, I'll watch a few more, but I get two, one on Friday night and one on Tuesday before I come back. So we're going to get Monday's show done before I go. Then Tuesday and Wednesday, we're off. Then we're back next Thursday. We come back with great stuff. Christian Bertelsen, chief investment officer from Avianz Capital, will be here. We've got Fred Vitese, author of The Essential Retirement Guide, and much, much more. So plenty of stuff. You should plan to be here. All right. I want to thank my guests from today, Tom Lydon, Bob Powell, Nathan Shadowin, and Mark Hulbert. I want to thank Rob Floyd, my producer, and I want to thank you. Now, here's that Money Life quote of the day. And again, you heard Mark talking about, hey, nobody beats the market. This quote comes from Merton Miller, who said, to beat the market, you'll have to invest serious bucks to dig up information no one else has yet. Yeah. Or maybe the information says that it's not necessarily worth your while. That's what Mark Hulbert said, and that's one of the reasons why we remind you that until we do this again the next time, the best thing you can do for your money is to not worry too much about it. Have a great day, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow.
This show is an informational service only. The information provided herein is not to be construed as an offer to buy or sell securities of any kind, and not to be considered a recommendation to buy any stock, but an information resource to aid the investor in making an informed decision. All listeners should consult a qualified professional before trading in any security or pursuing any financial or tax strategy. The information provided has been obtained from sources which are believed to be reliable, but is not guaranteed as to its accuracy or completeness.